such unbelievable things, unbelievable people. I tell you, one of the most extraordinary privileges to be a student of Rabbi Weinberg is to be a colleague of people like the people that you've heard from tonight. Absolutely amazing. So I gathered my notes and I wrote them down, and in the process of getting this together, I misplaced them. So, I'll just share the thoughts that arise and the words from my heart. What I think it's helpful for us to realize as context is that we live today in the year 2009 with an extraordinary degree of accomplishment in the realm of outreach. You know, just here in New York City, we have this Asia Torah branch. We have a whole division of campus outreach that is operating all over the New York area. We have the JICNY. We have the JEC downtown that's working with Birthright, doing amazing things. We have NJE. We have just gateways. It's unbelievable. But what's important to remember is that when Rabbi Weinberg was a teenager still, his father was Nifter. His father passed when he was 15 years old. And the next year, he, over the course of the summer, understood that it was going to be his responsibility to help make money for his family. So in the summers, he would travel around the United States of America. This is in the 40s. And he was always a very endearing and special person, and the communities took to him. And he describes that while the communities were deeply proud of their Jewish identity, and they loved the idea that there was this young yeshiva bacher who was going out to support his family, to make a living, and they wanted to help, what he saw was that when he scratched the surface to ask them, tell me about your Judaism, tell us about your Jewish community, what he saw was that despite their extraordinary pride, they were they were overwhelmingly unaware as to just what it means to be a Jew. They just didn't know. They didn't really have an articulate, thoughtful answer as to what does it mean. And immediately, as a teenager, he saw, this is not going well. This isn't going to be good. And so he started to speak to his colleagues and his rebbeim and others, what are we going to do? If you don't need to be an extraordinary Torah scholar to see that a generation that doesn't really know how to articulate the meaning of Judaism is going to have a hard time convincing their children to stay galvanized in their identities as Jews. And he wasn't seeing that there was a listening for it. There was just a lot of people kind of challenged by that message. And eventually he decided, as we saw briefly in the tribute video, that he needed to ask a leader that he thought would really take on the responsibility. He wasn't aware intimately of what was going on in North America, so he went to see the great, great scholar of the Jewish people at that time, the great leader, the Chazon Ish in Israel. And at that time there was boat travel to Israel. It was in the 50s. And on the way to Israel, the Chazon Ish passed. He passed away on the boat trip. And so he arrived and he didn't have the person that he meant to speak to, but he would speak to his colleagues and his teachers, and he was learning as a full-time student in one of the great academies in Jerusalem. And eventually he decided that, as he said, in the place where there isn't a leader, I have no choice but to step in and start something. So he decided he would found an organization, and he was going to leave his yeshiva, and his rabbi at the time, Rabbi Nosson Zvi Frankel, who was a great, great, great lover of the Jewish people, great scholar, great leader, he said, when he found out, he was disturbed. Rabbi Weinberg was, aside from his great power of will and his desire and his love for the Jewish people, he was an extraordinary scholar. Like, he loved learning Torah. His learning partners of that day said that he would sleep. He also slept 3 hours a day. Jody gets her inspiration from that. He would sleep from 12 to 1 at night, and from 6 to 7 in the morning, and again from 3 to 4 in the afternoon, approximately. That was his sleep schedule, because he knew that life was for acquiring the Word of God, it was for learning, it was for exerting yourself. It was short. So he was a great, great scholar, and he had tremendous potential, and the Rabbi Finkel said to him, what are you doing? What are you leaving for? Where are you going? He says, I'm going to start an organization to awaken the Jewish people against assimilation. And his first audience was the religious world, because who else is he going to speak to get partners to help him? And no one was listening. No one was interested. He couldn't get, he couldn't find partners. But Rabbi Finkel said, "You're crazy. What are you doing?" So he said, "Rebbe, if the Torah is likened to the bride of the Jewish people, if I were to introduce a guy to his fiance, do you think that he'd talk to him? Do you think I'd have some success in getting them to get together?" And Rabbi Finkel said, "If that's what you believe, then you should go. Like, if that's how you see it, if that's real to you, then go." And so he started an organization, and people used to say, he describes that when he would walk down the street, people would look at him and they would say, "There goes Noach the Meshugana. There goes Noach the crazy person." He thinks that you can change the trend. The way it was that people were moving away from Judaism. The overwhelming process was people had traditions and they were leaving it. And it was post-Holocaust, it was a very difficult time. And he started one organization, another organization. He started five different organizations, all out to try and recruit religious people to take up this banner, this fight with him. And every one of them, he says, failed. He closed every single one of them down. He started one yeshiva, another yeshiva, another yeshiva. His goal was to start an organization, a yeshiva that would... He needed to show people that it was possible to take a person who was unaffiliated, who didn't have the power of a Jewish education, and show them that it'll change your life, it'll transform the world that you live in, it'll create paradise on earth for you. It had to be shown that it was possible. So everyone said it's crazy, but he said that's what it looks to be. That's not what is. And so he did it. And despite the fact that his first four yeshivas did not accomplish his mission, he stuck with it, and he started a fifth organization. And he tells the story that in 1974, he was sitting in one room with five students, and he looked at these five students, and he said, "You and I are going to change the world." And the students say that they looked around at each other, and they looked at Rabbi Weinberg, and they say, "Who are you talking to, exactly?" And 5 years later, we see in the video that they started the first branch of Eish HaTorah in St. Louis. Then it was unthinkable. There weren't outreach organizations planted in the middle of communities where people lived and invited people to Shabbos and had guests and did events. And today, it's just all over the place. And today, the fastest growing division of the organization, Eish HaTorah International, is the division that is made up of people who grew up with a tremendous Jewish education, who are not professionals, but who care, who recognize, wow, we have something special. We should share it with people. It doesn't take you don't have to be a professional. You can just share your life. You can share what it means to you. That's the fastest growing. It's a different world we live in today, and it reminds me of the great that is an amazing from this week's Torah portion. There's a powerful relevance to the original to a story back in Parshas Noah. The story of Noah. Noah gets a bad rap for the flood. In fact, the flood itself is called Me Noach. It's called the waters of Noah. And so people ask, like, Noah was a great righteous person. Why are the floods called after him? That seems a bit derogatory to call the flood that wiped out the world the flood of Noah. He tried. So apparently he's chastised because he didn't try enough. And according to the Arizal, he writes in this book called the Sefer HaGilgulim, the book the book of reincarnations. He says there was a great leader that came after Noah that was a Gilgul, a reincarnation of Noah, who was confronted with the same challenge that Noah was confronted with and given the opportunity to fix what Noah didn't fix. And we see it in this week's portion, that when the Jewish people blow it with the golden calf, and they just completely, like, they turn their backs on this amazing relationship, so God gets upset at the Jewish people, and he's ready to wipe them out. And he says to Moses, he says, "Hanicha va'ata hanichali, v'yichar api, v'achalem otam." And now, leave me be. Let me go already, and I'm going to get angry, and I'm going to wipe them out. Rashi points out, what does it mean, "and now leave me be"? Moses never began to argue with God to tell him, don't wipe them out. And God is saying, stop already, stop, leave me be, and I'm going to get angry. Rashi explains that was God's way of telling Moses, start with me. Fight for the Jewish people. Don't give up. And so Moses says to God, he says, nothing doing. There's no wiping out the Jewish people. If you're going to wipe out the Jewish people, wipe me out too. He says, Macheni no misifrecha, wipe me out of your book. And the sages point out that the word Macheni, wipe me out, it can be rearranged. And you know what the words that it spells rearranged? Macheni spells me noach. Because Moses understood there's no, like, every last Jew is one of the Almighty's children. Every last human being is precious. There's no, like, he defined his obligations, he defined what was possible by what he understood was the Creator's will. That was it. He didn't define his sense of responsibility by what he was good at, by his comforts, by his good feelings. He defined his responsibility by his perception of what he could do based on what was responsibility. And it's just amazing to me that I also am buttressed by that vision and by that sense of responsibility in my own small way. For him, one of the things that was so real was, you know, how did he do it? How did he fight? How did he get to find strength? And we heard this from so many, you know, the Almighty loves you. The Creator of the universe loves you. And he describes that when he was a kid, he was somewhat assimilated. Of all his siblings, he was religious, but he was the least religious. He was into the pub, he was into stickball after school, and the shadow on the radio, and he was not the most religious of his siblings. And he says that his father knew him well, and his father taught him something that changed his life, and he used that to change others' lives. Whenever his father would see him, his father would say to him, Noach, do you know that there's a God? So, okay, he's a religious kid. He lives in a religious home. They keep Shabbos. They daven, all that stuff. So he turns to his father and he says, yeah, I know there's a God. And his father would say to him, you just did a very big mitzvah. Big mitzvah. And he would say that to his son week in, week out, week in, week out. He would just drip in this message, you're succeeding as a Jew. You are succeeding as a Jew in a big way. Just remember there's a Creator. So he taught that to us. You know, when I came to New York for the first time, he implored me, please remember. Every day, 10 times a day, you got to stop and remember. The Almighty's with you. Once I went to his office when he was in New York, and I was sharing with him a challenge, a question, and he sat me down and he said to me, do you know that I'm sitting in front of you around? Do you see me? I wasn't exactly sure where he was going with this. And I said, yeah, I see you. And he says, do you realize that I have thoughts and I'm thinking thoughts right now and I'm even thinking of you right now? And I said, okay, that makes sense. And he says, do you know I have a certain affection for you right now? And then he like flashes his big smile. He says, you know, it would be funny for you to walk into this room and walk around and pretend like I didn't exist. It's a small office, you know, it would be funny. You walk into this room and like go to the bookshelf, look out the window, you know, and here I am sitting and you don't talk to me, you ignore me. That would be funny, right? And then he said to me, you know, the Almighty is no less real than I am. Don't ignore him. Let him in. Use him. Rely on him. Be with him. And he taught parents to teach their children, but it's really he taught all of us because we were all his kids. He said, ask your children the question, how do you give your children self-esteem? And really, whenever he taught us how to teach someone else, he was really just trying to teach us. How do you get your kids to have self-esteem? He said, ask them this question. Ask them, who loves you in this world more than anyone else? And of course, they're going to answer, mommy, daddy. Then he'd say, tell them, no, it's not true. Who loves you more than anyone else? And they would think, and they would say, Hashem. And he would say, big mitzvah. And so today, in my own life, you know, I have children. My oldest is almost 8, and I have a 6-year-old. And when I'm going to bed with them at night, it's a little bit of a peaceful time. I'm helping them go to bed. I ask them that question. I say, who loves you more than anyone in the whole world? So now they know. And they say, Hashem. Right away. And I say, but who loves you next? They say, mommy and tati. And I look at them and I smile and I say, can you imagine there's someone who loves you more than Mommy and Poppy? Can you believe? And they get this big smile and they get so excited. And it just, as I'm doing it, the whole thing is just working on me. You know, like it's connecting with me how silly I am at times and how powerful a teaching this is. Imagine the gift of a child walking around knowing whatever he is, whatever he's doing, wherever he's going, he's beloved. Ah, it's so powerful. That was the way that Rabbi Weinberg looked at Torah, that Torah was life-changing. Every aspect of it was life-changing. And that if we just relied on Torah, if we just relied on the presence of our Creator, on the love of our Creator, we'll be great. We'll be unstoppable. We'll be such powerful people. And he was so real. He was so real. I went to him one time to ask him on Rosh Hashanah, what do you pray for, Rabbi? What's your prayer on Rosh Hashanah? And you know, it kind of weirded me out what his prayer was. You know what his prayer was? His prayer every Rosh Hashanah was, Almighty, wake me up. Can you imagine? The Day of Judgment. We're all standing in the presence of our Creator. We know that it's an awesome day. His prayer to the Creator is, Almighty, wake me up. Rabbi Greenman mentioned clarity or death. He really understood that. He really understood that this world, we get so distracted. We get so distracted with how with so many things, but it's so much bigger than that, and it would be worth suffering something to get clarity. It would be worth it. I couldn't say that prayer. It was too much. I would say, please wake me up without pain, without difficulty. But wake me up. That was our version of his prayer. And you know, it was also this one last thought. I just remember, you know, how much he insisted and how clear he was that his success was the success of the Creator. It was not him. He was so much, it's not me. It's just a matter of me undertaking. I remember I was so pleased and proud after I got married and I wanted to introduce him to my wife. I was so proud. I landed such a great girl and I'm going to show her off to him and be so proud, etc. And so I introduce her for the first time and they're sitting in the office and they're meeting and I'm sitting outside and I'm so excited, you know, and they come out and after a while of talking and my wife walks down the stairs and I say to Rabbi Weinberg, say, I did pretty good, huh? I did pretty good. And he, without hesitation, and he looks at me and says, please, the Almighty loves you. And that was his message. Like, you know, what does it have to do with you? You know, you're like, the Almighty loves you. That's why you have a great wife. And he lived with that, and he was real with that, and he had this way of sharing the challenges of the Jewish people with people. He didn't tell them exactly what to do. He inspired them with his love and his care. He cared so much that you stood in his presence, you realized, how can I not care? How can I not care? How can I not care? And once you walked out of there, you realized, I got to deal with this. It's my problem. It's my problem. And I look around at my amazing colleagues and the people who are his students who look at him as an inspiration, and I see the amazing things that they've undertaken, and I say to myself, He just, it's amazing, the people that he took from nowhere who were assimilated, who had no clue about their identities as Jewish and how precious it is, and now these people are leaders whose students have students and students. It's amazing, his care and his love just broke through everything. And so as my colleagues pointed out, and as Steve pointed out in particular, the challenge that we have is to ask ourselves, what are we going to do? At one of the last meetings that I recall him being in full form, the question was asked him, what's going to be when the Roshiva is no longer able to run the operations of Eish HaTorah? What's going to be when he's no longer capable of doing that? And so he said, you know, of all of my successes over the years, I think my biggest failing is that I really never got you guys to replace me. That's my biggest failing. I never, ever got you to replace me. And when I'm gone, the thing I'm most encouraged by is that you will replace me. that you'll realize that I'm not around, and you will replace me in ideas and in sense of commitment and vision and responsibility, whatever, you'll replace me. That was his legacy. And all of us are here tonight because we've been touched by his message and by who he was, by his love for the Jewish people, by his clarity that there's a reality to this world that we don't want to miss out on, that we want to, it's our pleasure to fight. He used to say after all the frustrations that people experienced, he said, you know, it would be worth all of it, all of the work that I've been through, all of the suffering and the pain and the attacks and the, all of it would be worth it just to have suffered pain on behalf of the fight for the Jewish people. Without any of the results, just the pain alone would have been worth it. That was his clarity about how precious it is to be a part of this task. So our question that we have to ask ourselves is, what will we do? How will we step forward and partake of his love and his passion and his commitment and his truth to replace him and to be the vision that he saw and cared for? And so we've placed, I don't know if you have